So I went down to my favorite store, picked out three or four shirts or more, a pair of pants and a striped tie, and the man came by and said, "Yes, sir, cash or charge?" I said, "Just put it on my credit card." Write that dude up. Oh, convenient.
Good morning. It's just after 8 o'clock here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Gene Purcell with you this week, filling in for Joy Cardine. And Kevin McKinley is with us again today for another hour of On Your Money. And as always, we have an awful lot to talk about. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Gene.
Oh, I like that. That's very, very excited. Good.
Thank you.
Good to have you along. We are going to be talking about cash in the first part of the program today, and I have to tell you, I feel a little old school, but there are a number of, because I still use cash for a lot of things, but as I understand it, there's a number of new technologies that might be making what we call cash an obsolete way to pay.
Yep, several new developments taking place that will just make it more difficult to do things that you were once able to do with relative ease. Some of them are standard, some are quite advanced, and some are happening on the fringes of society but are interesting nonetheless. The first one is that prepaid plastic, those charge cards, are becoming much more ubiquitous. This is where people carry around their plastic, and when they need money or are getting money from a source, it gets charged up and replenished, and then they spend it down basically wherever they please and whatever merchant will accept it. About 40 states currently use the prepaid plastic to deliver unemployment benefits for unemployed people. Social Security recently gave people an option to either get direct deposit of the checks or a card issued, I believe, through Comerica, and you have no option of getting a paper check from Social Security sent to your house anymore. There is a huge project in California right now where about 2 million recipients of different kinds of benefits like disability and unemployment and healthcare benefits will get that dollar amount charged onto prepaid cards through Visa. Now, some of the problems with this are fairly obvious. One is which it's difficult to know exactly how much you have on a card unless you have the ability to swipe the card, whereas if you have just a $20 bill, you can tell that it's a $20 bill. Another issue is that many of these banks are looking to prepaid cards as a way to build up revenue, not in a huge dollar amount, but in tiny, tiny increments where it might cost you, say, $1.50 if you have a transaction that's denied, or maybe 50 cents to check your balance or something like that. And then privacy advocates obviously don't like it either, because many are saying that, look, there's a deposit now of information of where these people are spending their money, whereas when we were just sending them cash or sending them checks, they were free to do it wherever and whenever and for how much they wanted to.
Yeah, these prepaid plastic cards are sort of the tip of the iceberg. What else is on the horizon?
That you will be able to pay with your cell phone or your smartphone, which is a technology and a practice that's already very widespread in Europe and parts of Asia. But Google Wallet just announced a program where, through the use of a Google platform and a Citibank MasterCard, you will be able to just hold your phone over a reader and transmit the payment information directly to a merchant. Visa is also working on a similar program, certainly not to be outdone. Some people are saying this is more secure because it can't be lost. And unlike just a credit card that gets stolen or if the number gets compromised, there has to be both a PIN number plus a chip inside of it here. The fear, of course, and Google is not charging a fee to use this service, but the fear, of course, is that they're going to use this technology to market sales and services to people who are buying certain things with their smartphone. It's an easier way to deliver information about coupons, etc.
And I've heard of using cell phones and smartphones for these sorts of things, but one of the things I have not heard of are what you call fringe currencies.
Yeah, there's an interesting, it's really just a software program, and it's called Bitcoins, B-I-T-C-O-I-N-S, and it's a digital currency that's been created by an algorithm and a software program by a few different engineers, and it's basically a finite amount that's about 6.5 million Bitcoins right now, and there's a cap on how many Bitcoins can be created at 21 million. Right now, the value fluctuates relative to dollars, like other types of currencies, like the euro or the yen. But it's worth about 21 U.S. dollars right now. And basically, you set up an account, and then you can transfer bitcoins from one user to another, and all of the transactions are posted, but the user and the recipients and deliverers of the bitcoins are not. And some people like this because there's no government intervention for it. The government is, however, getting interested in this because one of the most notorious uses of this Bitcoin currency so far is an online anonymous drug selling, of a place that sells illicit and illegal drugs. People like to use the Bitcoins to pay for those drugs because it's an anonymous currency.
Yeah, and that would, to me, that tells me that people should be thinking about potential fraud and abuse with some of these options.
Yes, you'd think so. But other than just getting your cash taken away from you, there are some other issues with cash that many of these technologies actually don't have. For instance, the U.S. Secret Service just put out an alert that said they really want people to start keeping a close eye on the cash that they receive and spend, because there's been a big jump in the number of increased counterfeit bills spreading throughout the system. In 2009, the government confiscated $182 million worth of fake currency. And as the government tries to stay one step ahead of the counterfeiters are working much harder to try to mock and emulate the actual legitimate currency. So they're saying you should actually, if you see something that's suspicious, Secret Service says you should check the bill, save it, try to handle it as little as possible. And one thing they said, which is a good idea, don't try to pass the bill on to some other sucker, because then you've become a counterfeiter yourself. So save it and keep a good eye on it when you receive it, so you know not only from who gave it to you, but also where you received it, so the Secret Service can try to track that down.
It's more complicated than ever, and for the moment, I have to tell you that I'm going to continue to carry cash.
Good idea. Less money, less problems.
lots of less money, actually. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors before making any investment decisions. And we'd like to just remind you about that, and also remind you that you can call in with your questions, 800-642-1234. We have some open lines for you right now, 800-642-1234. You can also email questions to onyourmoney, all one word, onyourmoney at WPR.org. All right, it's time for the mailbag segment, and today we respond to not one, not two, but three questions, all with the same answer. Jean, Regina, and Catherine all want to know where they can find a fee-based financial planner. Kevin, where do they start?
Well, it's obviously a very commonly asked question. We've answered it before, and I'm guessing we will answer it again. Most financial advisors are paid by commission, meaning that they give you advice on where you should put the money, and then the financial advisors receive a small commission. It's usually a few percentage points of the value of the investment as compensation for not only hopefully helping you pick the investment out, but also guiding you along the way. A smaller portion charged by a percentage of assets that they manage, where they generally charge little or no commission to you to make buys and sells, but they charge a fee almost like a retainer that typically runs from 0.5% to 1.5% of the assets per year. A very small portion of financial planners charge by the hour, like lawyers or CPAs or plumbers do. The idea behind that, of course, is that if you're paying someone either a fee or an hourly fee to help you out, they have less incentive to sell you a particular product that you may actually not want or not need, or might be more expensive because there is commission built into it, and ostensibly offer more comprehensive planning than what a traditional commission-based advisor can offer. There are really good advisors who get paid by commission, and there are advisors who charge by the hour or by fees who may not be right for you. And so you really have to find the right person first, and hopefully the way that you're paying that person is not only obvious, but it's comfortable for you.
Yeah, those are a lot of options, though. So where might our listeners start looking?
There are two or three different organizations which try to help people find fee-based financial planners and advisors. One is FPANet.org. That's the Financial Planners Association. The other is NAPFA, NAPFA.org. That's the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors. And then if people are looking for a certified financial planner, you can go to CFP.net. Now, we will have links up to all those sites at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today. Now, when you do use it, you will find a couple of things. First of all, there are not a whole lot of people registered there in the Wisconsin area. Second of all, even if you do find someone there whom will take your business and is a good fit for you, you might not like that particular person and their philosophy about managing your money. For instance, some certified financial planners are very good at what they do. They also charge commission on products that they sell. So even if you can find a person there you like, that may not be the be-all, end-all of looking for a fee-based financial planner.
Yeah, what if you can't find a person? Where else can people get some help?
Well, many of the larger so-called discount financial services companies are starting to offer some kind of basic financial planning and recommendations like Fidelity or Vanguard or Schwab and USAA, which is a firm we've discussed here before. There's usually little or no cost to this. It might be anywhere from a few hundred dollars, definitely no more than a few thousand dollars. But ostensibly, there's supposed to be less conflict of interest. They're going to recommend things that they sell on their platform, but hopefully not things that they earn more money from than other ones. And keep in mind, even with those organizations, and I've seen some nice things done with clients I have who have gone to them first, you're still talking with an employee of an organization whose first goal is generally to serve the organization, not you. And you hope that you can find someone whose goal is to serve you rather than the needs of the organization. Then you pay them and the organization gets paid. And that's supposedly the way it's supposed to work. But it doesn't always happen that way, obviously, by how many questions we get on this topic.
And so when should people start thinking about this? I mean, my guess is you're going to say something like sooner rather than later.
One of two things happens when you do find some kind of financial advisor who can help you. Either you are relieved that what you have been doing is the right thing, that you've been maximizing every opportunity and not been making any mistakes, or you find out some information about your situation that had you left it untended could have created a problem for you, and you hopefully find it out before it's too late. Either one of those events are a good thing, and usually most people who get in, it's just like a medical checkup. You're relieved to find out you're in good health, or the doctor catches something that is caught soon enough that can be treated relatively easily rather than waiting until it becomes acute.
All right, stuff to think about. We're going to be taking a break right now. When we return, we've got some phone calls lined up. We've got some questions for Kevin, and we'd like to hear from you too. 800-642-1234. Our email works as well, and our email address, onyourmoney, all one word, onyourmoney@WPR.org. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 22 minutes past 8 o'clock. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Joy Cardine. Coming up after 5 this afternoon, Steve Jobs of Apple Computer recently announced Apple Computer's newest application, the iCloud service. Join Ben Marins and his guest in a conversation about the newest Apple technology, what it does, and how it will change how we use our computers. That's coming up this afternoon after 5. For the rest of this hour, it's Kevin McKinley on Your Money, and we're going to head right to the phones right now. And reminder that our phone number is 800-642-1234. Let's start with Gino, who joins us from Milwaukee. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I have a situation where myself and three siblings will be getting an inheritance. It's four CDs. Two of them are IRA and two of them aren't. And it's about $100,000, so I realize there won't be any inheritance tax. But will we incur income tax on those?
All right, Kevin, there's a question.
Yeah, Gino, you will, whoever, are you splitting everything four ways, or are some people getting the IRAs and other people getting the non-IRAs?
Everything is split four ways. And there's also a small insurance policy for about $13,000, but that's going to be covering, which I'm the beneficiary, but that'll be covering the funeral expenses. So I'm hoping that that won't be taxed either.
Yeah, it's very likely that the insurance policy, if it's a life insurance policy, there will be no tax on that.
Okay.
The IRAs, if they are regular IRAs, generally, if they're set up, what happens is the IRA they're rolled into what are called decedent IRAs or inheritor IRAs, and then the money is required to be taken out, but only in a very small amount every single year based on the life expectancy of the inheritors. That's the good news, is you can kind of manage how you take the money out if you don't need it right away. The bad news is, technically, it's taxable income. Now, whether it's actually taxable to you depends on the rest of your income that you're receiving, whether it's from Social Security or earnings or other types of distributions from retirement plans. That's what will really determine. But technically, yes, the IRA distributions to you when you take them are taxable. And when you set them up, make sure you not only set them up and title the money accounts appropriately, but also make sure you take out those required minimum distributions, because if you miss one and the IRS finds out about it, there's a 50% excise tax on what you should have taken out, and you still have to take the same dollar amount. So let's say the IRS says, well, based on the dollar amount and the life expectancy, you were supposed to take $1,000 out of this IRA and have it be taxed as income, but you didn't. So not only do you still have to take the $1,000 out, but you have to take another $500 and pay us as an excise tax for not doing what you were supposed to do.
So you're saying that we cannot close these out completely? It would be about 25 out of all four CDs. It would be about 25,000 apiece.
You can close them out, but if you take them out and spend the money or put it in some other type of investment, if you don't transfer directly into an inheritor IRA, then yes, then you have to pay taxes on any IRA money. Probably not on the CDs. There'll be little or no tax liability on those. But the IRAs, yes, technically they're taxable income if you take the money out and spend it.
All right, Gino, thanks so much for the call. Let's move on to Marie, who joins us from Appleton. Good morning.
Good morning. The reason why I'm calling is because recently we were given the option at my job to have a 403B and have like somebody manage your account based on your retirement date. So I went ahead and switched to that kind of plan because I'm really not savvy on stocks and bonds and all that. And I just want to know, are there any cons to having that kind of plan based on a retirement date and they manage it for you versus doing it yourself?
The cons, Maria, are the cost, and that's only a con if you don't feel you are receiving enough benefit to offset the cost. If you are aware of the cost and it seems like something that makes you feel better about the system and the situation, I think it's worth it. And if you say, I know what the fees are and it really doesn't seem like they're doing anything that I couldn't do on my own, then it's not worth it. And that really, the nice thing about it, Maria, is that's entirely up to you and your perception. It's your money. So you get to decide if whatever they're charging you to do it is actually worth what you are receiving.
Go ahead, Marie.
It's not that much money that they charge you. The fee's not that much, but I just thought maybe somebody that knew about what would be best for my projected retirement date would be better than me, just not as educated on that issue, just picking stuff that I didn't know if it was going to work for me in the long run.
Sure, and you hope that it does. And sometimes it's usually just peace of mind that you're actually paying, of saying, look, this is someone else's problem. It's not my problem because I'm paying someone else to do it. Now, depending on how custom individualized the advice can be, obviously the more individualized it is, the more you're probably going to pay. But if many services exist that are just scalable services, they say you answer, you fill out a questionnaire, and then they create a portfolio for you. That's usually better than nothing, as long as you adhere to the plan and the plan is a good one. Sometimes people can even do this for themselves without paying any type of advisor for it, by setting what are known as target date funds in their retirement plans. And many employers offer these, where you pick a date that you're going to retire in the future, and then the portfolios are kind of scaled toward becoming more conservative as that date comes closer. That doesn't prevent you from losing money in them. They'll still fluctuate in value usually. And it also doesn't mean that it's going to be perfect for you, but it is a plan, and so many people don't have any plan whatsoever, that sometimes just having one, and one that they can stick to through good times and bad times, is well worth the cost.
800-642-1234 is our number if you'd like to join in the discussion, or you can email onyourmoney@WPR.org. Let's go to Toma, and Denise is with us. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for the program.
Mm-hmm.
See, I was curious. I have an idea for a tax deduction, but I don't know if it exists or not. We have a lot.
Give it a shot. See what happens.
Okay, we'll see what happens. Okay. There's so many people that maybe have health insurance but not dental insurance. And there seems to be an awful gap in that situation. And I was curious, are there any programs that exist for people who need to do something with their money for a tax deduction to pony up with specific dentists and then, just have that money in a fund and whatever is not covered by, say, their Medicaid or Medicare, because usually it's that, that money could then be drawn from that fund. Are there any programs like that?
Well, that is actually a good question. So you're saying it's almost like a health savings account except for dental expenses.
Yes, and that way it would go directly to the dentist, not through the government. Do you see what I'm saying? I have an idea for like a Project Smile, and I was curious if something like that has been done or not.
That's a good question. The publication that you want to look at, I'm not quite sure. I think maybe we have a Venn diagram between charitable deductions and then people getting individual deduction. But if you want to know which dental expenses are already tax deductible or can be at least, it's topic 502 is the IRS topic. But are you saying you want to know if people could donate money and then...
Yes. I mean, my husband's a physician here in town, but we see an awful gap in what, dental care issues. A lot of folks just do not have dental care. And I'm just wondering if perhaps the dentists wouldn't be more willing to accept patients with Medicaid, Medicare, that type of thing, or those that were just no pay for whatever reason. And then that money would be drawn directly from the fund that is with the dentist.
Then you want to look up at setting up a nonprofit and getting the 501c3 whatever status so that people can hopefully get a tax deduction on donations to it, and then people could draw out of it. That is a noble endeavor, and it's something that would definitely require a lot of work, but I think you're right. I think dental care is not only vastly overlooked for people, it's an easy one to neglect until the problem becomes too late. And as someone who's familiar with the medicine, as you and your husband are, that that can lead to very chronic problems that many people aren't aware of.
Oh, yes, it definitely does. But, okay, so I need to be looking at setting up something probably that's non-profit then.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, that's an idea.
All right.
Good luck.
Yeah, okay. Good luck, Denise. Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
Denise calling us from Toma, and all kinds of ideas here on Your Money and Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-642-1234 is our toll-free number, or you can email us at onyourmoney@WPR.org.
Just whistle while you work, and cheerfully
Well, it's funny you should mention whistling while you work. I was whistling just this morning on my way into the studios, and just a great day to be at work. But, if you're a working teenager or if you are the parent of one, there are always some issues there, and you should be thinking about some of the financial pitfalls and, of course, some of the financial opportunities.
Gene, you weren't with us last week, but you no doubt listened, so you doubt know that Joy and I discussed the high rate of unemployment with working teens. Right now, people who are age 16 to 19, there's a nearly 24% rate of unemployment, and that's just among teens who say they're actually looking for work rather than those whose parents are trying to get them off the couch or out of bed and actually to do something this summer in between school. But whether one is working as an employee or a contractor or for oneself or for a parent or for a parent who is actually an employer anyway, all those different scenarios are treated differently by the IRS and all have several different requirements, but all have one common beneficial option.
And what is that beneficial option?
I will tell you that down the road.
Oh, okay. Well, fair enough. Let's start out talking about these categories one at a time. And let's take the easiest one first, I guess. Let's start out with teenagers who might wind up being an employee.
Okay. Well, first of all, even those who get a job at fast food restaurant or movie theater, they still may be able to avoid withholding from their paycheck. If they file a W-4, get an exemption, they might also be able to avoid having to file if their income is low enough. But if their income is low, generally it can go on to the parents' adjusted gross income, and that can kick the parents' income up enough where not only they have to pay taxes at a higher rate than the kid would otherwise pay, but they can lose out on some exemptions because many tax exemptions are tied to a parent's adjusted gross income.
And that, of course, is for the kids who might actually wind up getting a job and becoming an employee. But what about kids who just decide that route's not going to work? They wind up going like a general contractor route, or they wind up being self-employed?
Yeah, I encourage that. For kids who say, you know what, there aren't any jobs out there for me and there's nothing really that interests me, if they're going door to door trying to, lawn mowing or babysitting or helping out around a person's house, house watching, pet sitting, then a few different rules apply. Independent contractors generally have no withholding, but if they earn enough money, they may have to pay later and get surprised by a 1099 that says that, oh, you owe a bunch of money. So they should definitely track all of their expenses and keep good receipts while they are incurring those expenses. So hopefully the expenses can offset any tax liability later on. If they are actually self-employed, they do have to pay payroll taxes on that money, and they may have to pay income taxes. But again, the income might be small enough where they can get out from under it because they just don't make enough to offset the deductions.
What if the job they wind up getting is a kid essentially being paid by their parents?
Well, there are a couple of different ways that might occur. First of all, if the parents actually own a business, let's say they own a hamburger stand and they're employing the kids, it's a pretty neat deal because they may not have to pay Medicare or Social Security tax if the parents are sole proprietors or a mom and pop partnership and the kids are under 18. If the kids are doing work around the house, say they're going to paint the garage, first of all, the pay has to be fair and reasonable. You can't say, well, I'm going to try as a tax dodge to give my kid $5,000 to stare at the TV for 6 hours today. It has to be, you have to be able to justify it, saying, well, this is a normal rate that I would otherwise pay any teenager to do this kind of work. And the nice thing, though, is the kid is under 21. There will be no payroll or unemployment taxes, the IRS announced recently.
Let's go back to that big beneficial option. What do you see as the big opportunity for working teens?
Well, that is to use the income as a contribution for an IRA or a Roth IRA. The only reason I would want them to use an IRA is if they just want to get the tax deduction and then not so much save on the taxes, but save on the hassle of having to file to reduce the income below the filing floor, if you will. Otherwise, it's much better to use a Roth IRA for a working teenager because the kid can pull the money back out at any time for any reason as long as it's the contribution portion with no taxes or penalties. Once the kid retires, there's no taxes on any kind of withdrawal, and the kid doesn't even have to put her own money into the Roth IRA. Parents or grandparents or whomever can make a gift to the kid where the money can then be put into the IRA or Roth IRA. Now, it does become a completed gift, so there are some laws about that. But if they're going to do that, they generally want to do that before the kid's going to be applying for financial aid for college if they can help it, because that gift might come in the taxable or the income that the kid is going to have to declare on the financial aid report. And the really neat thing about this, Gene, is that let's say a kid works from 16, 17, and 18 and earns $5,000 a year, which is $7 an hour at 15 hours a week. That's about $5,000 that can be put into a Roth IRA. And if you make three $5,000 deposits, of $15,000 total, and then that money earns 7% a year, hypothetically, by the time the kid turns 65, the $15,000 deposited will be worth over $425,000, and if it's in a Roth IRA, it'll be completely tax-free.
But I have to ask you this, I mean, we've talked about this before, it's never too early to start planning for retirement. How do you convince a 15-year-old kid that they ought to be saving that money, or is that something the parents should be thinking about?
That's a very difficult notion to do, especially if the kid is working hard and it's the first money they've earned. One thing you can do if you say, well, I want to try to get that money in there, but I also want to try to foster some saving for the kids, is offer a matching contribution and say, look, if you have $500 that you'll put into the Roth IRA, I'll match that, whether it's a dollar for dollar or $10 per dollar, as long as it's perfectly legal and you don't exceed the limits of contributions, you can put your own money in to match what the kid puts into the IRA or Roth IRA.
You understand, of course, that I'm going to be building a time machine so I can go back to when I was 15, and I'm going to be depositing $15,000, and then I'll be all set. All right, let's head back to the phones right now. 800-642-1234 is our toll-free number if you'd like to join in. Email works, too. Our address is onyourmoney@wpr.org. Donna is with us now, it looks like, from Sirona. Hi, Donna.
Hello. I'm wondering, can you deduct from your taxes, if you're on Medicare, your supplement insurance?
And I'm sorry, Donna, what was the question again? If you're...
Can you deduct your supplement insurance if you're on Medicare?
Oh, I see. You're paying extra for a supplemental insurance policy. I see. And again, Kevin, what do you think?
That's a good question. Are you itemizing your deductions anyway?
Yes, I'm self-employed.
You're self-employed. Okay. You're self-employed and on Medicare?
Yes.
Okay. Good for you. Okay. So you're both retired and working. All right.
Yes. I am. My husband's retired.
Your husband's retired. You know what? I don't believe that those are deductible to the extent that... they may fall in the category of the medical expenses as long as they exceed 7.5% of your adjusted gross income, but I am actually not sure about that, Donna, if that's the case or not.
Wow.
You've stumped me.
All right.
Well, my goodness.
We should get a gong or something for the program when we're able to stump Kevin McKinley. Well, Donna,
yeah, it's been 8 years, I think, and that's the first time that I've actually been stumped on something.
There we go. Get a book or something. Well, let's move on to Eric, who joins us from Superior, and we'll see if he can stump Kevin McKinley, too. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning. My question relates to a scenario about the resale of a piece of property, vacant land, and I'll just lay that out first. The time machine would have been handy, but the situation is that it will result in income, and I have two questions. Will it be capital gain or ordinary income, and is that based on how much it is or the time frame? Anyway, land was purchased in about 2001, and as it turns out, if I sell the land this year, then my question is, can I count the taxes, real estate taxes, on that piece of vacant land over the years intervening against the cost basis for, you know, figuring out how much the income is when I sell the land? And here's the wrinkle whereby I should have asked this question that many years ago. My tax preparer has been taking since my wife and I own several properties. My tax preparer has been entering on a line, which she told me what the line number was, but Kevin, you probably know, when all of the real estate taxes you pay, not only on your homestead place where you live, but all of the real estate taxes are entered somewhere on a schedule as we reported income over the years. So would that mean that if I were to take it as a cost basis, I'd have to go back and refile all those years?
Yeah, recapture for that. I'm disappointed in two things. First of all, that you overestimate my knowledge. Second of all, that you have a tax person, yet this question has gone unanswered. Have you asked the tax person this question?
I have asked the question in a cursory fashion, and it seems that I have gotten the definitive answer that it's entirely legal to count that money against the cost basis because if you, in other words, if the scenario was this simplistic that we were saying, okay, let me buy land this year and then sell it 5 years from now, mm-hmm. and as I have to incur expenses against that property, then the real estate would be one of those expenses. And apparently that is entirely legal. So maybe the question just relates to would I have to go back and refile? And if you do or don't know, I still respect your knowledge, and that's why I'm calling.
Well, thank you very much. I don't want to go too much into the situation to make a definitive answer for you. However, I will say this. Are you planning on just selling the property anyway, or is it really tax-driven why you're looking to sell it?
It's not tax-driven. I don't make enough money for anything on my part to be tax-driven. I keep my eyes open for opportunities, and since I understand land and you know would someday have otherwise taken this piece of land and after retirement built a house on it for mm-hmm. additional income, I just, you know, I understand land and buildings, so that's what I do. And now it turns out that I really need to sell the piece of land, and it's just a piece of vacant land, so that's how the question comes up. But
okay.
I believe I have acquaintances who are builders who indicate to me also that, you know, if a builder buys three lots and what he's doing as years go by is always building a house and selling it to someone, then the taxes that he's incurring, they're all business expenses.
Yeah, it's very tricky, as you are delineating for us right now. Two things about this. First of all, I'm glad to hear you are not tax consequences of selling anything or any type of investment should definitely be considered. It should not be the dictating force of whether or not you sell something. So I'm glad to hear that you're considering it and researching it, but not actually letting the tax tail wag your money dog. Second of all, if you are not confident enough in your tax preparer's advice, get a second opinion, not only because you'll either validate the tax person's advice or you'll find out that you were about to make a big mistake on this situation. And if it's more than $500 or $1,000 of potential tax ramifications, it will be a very good investment to find a real CPA who has an expertise in real estate development, recapture, capital gains, so that you know for sure that what you're trying to do is the right thing.
All right, Eric, thanks so much for the call, and we're going to take a break. And when we return, we are going to round out the hour of Kevin McKinley on Your Money. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Supporters of WPR include Bach Dancing and Dynamite Society presenting Bach to the Future, a 20th season Bacchanal, June 10th through June 25th at the Overture Center and other locations. Tickets at the door or at bachdancinganddynamite.org.
This hotel room got a lot of stuff, a laundry bag and a shoe shine cloth. 32 hangers and a touch-tone phone with a light that goes on when I ain't home.
It's Kevin McKinley on Your Money here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and we continue our series of tips on how to save money when you're on the road this summer. We've got some ideas about cutting your lodging expenses.
Well, the first thing, Gene, is that travelers should not start with hotels. They should consider the longer their vacation is and the longer they're staying in one place, the more economical it might be to look at homes or apartments or timeshares or condos. Many universities, especially during the summer, have great deals where the general public can stay in the dorms at a very discounted rate or some other type of lodging. And generally the universities are in a neat location. All the amenities are there, but the costs are much more affordable than a hotel room in the same location. And finally, the bed and breakfast industry in both Wisconsin and nationwide, it's a tough business. And many of those B&Bs have cut their prices down to the point where they're very close to the average cost of a hotel room. And generally, depending on the B&B, you can have a much more enjoyable experience there, save some money, and forget about having to, you know, fight over the kids running down the hall or on their way to the swimming pool.
What about those travelers, though, who just want to get the best deal that they can get on a plain old hotel room?
Well, first of all, know your discount options. If you belong to AAA or ARP, or you work for an employer that has a savings program, or if you're a senior or you have a military background, there are generally going to be 10 to 20% discounts right off the top for just about every kind of hotel stay. What you want to do is look online, either at the hotel's website or use some of the search engines, like kayak.com is one of our favorites. And if you want to save some money overall on your trip, try to find one that has both some type of kitchenette, meaning like a microwave and a sink, hopefully, and something where you can go nearby and purchase groceries, because then you can save a lot of money dining out and probably eat a little healthier as well. Once you find a hotel that works, contact the hotel and ask about construction going on, because it can be very daunting when you check into a room and find out that you're going to hear jackhammers all night, where the room is going to be located, if it's near a hallway or near the swimming pool or near an elevator. And then this is the most important feature when trying to save money on a hotel room, is check and see what the cancellation terms are and what the fees are of the room you're specifically looking to purchase.
All right, so I've done all this homework. I've found the right room at the right price. What do I do next?
Well, rather than booking online, contact the hotel directly, and not the toll-free reservations line. Contact the actual front desk. Ask for the room rate of the room that you have an interest in, and then ask the person at the desk if they have any other options out there for an upgrade or rooms and specials that they're offering for it. And what you can say is, hey, you know what, that's a little more than I want to pay. Here's my contact information. If something comes up at a better price, will you please give me a call and let me know? And that allows the hotel operator to save some face, but still get you in the room at a price that they'd be more comfortable at, and for you to save some money as well. Most importantly, you want to keep your options open. So if you do finally settle on a room, avoid something that is non-cancelable and non-refundable so that you have options later on.
And then what?
Well, in the hours before you check in and the cancellation window expires, call around to other hotels in the area and say, hey, has anything come up at the last minute? Have there been any cancellations where I can get a better deal than what I'm currently paying? And if they find out you already have a room reserved and it's something that they can steal a customer away from another competitor, they'll be usually happy to give you some kind of discount if they can. You also find out that there might be some new openings and some new deals that you weren't aware of when you were calling around weeks or months earlier.
And I don't imagine it's open. You've done all this work up to this point, and now I'm finally at the desk and I'm checking in. What do I do now?
Well, a couple of points. First of all, make sure while you're checking in, they might say, are you a member of our blah, 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 member rewards, royalty points? It doesn't hurt to apply at that point as long as there's no fee, and usually you'll get points for that stay, which will help offset your next stay there. Also, if you're traveling on a budget, don't use a debit card, because if you have a very small amount of money in your checking account that's drawing from the debit, sometimes hotels and rental car agencies will hold a larger amount of that money in case there's any damages down the road, so that it actually, in essence, depletes the account temporarily. So don't use a debit card, use a credit card. And if you do use a credit card and there are problems down the road, it's much easier to dispute it using the credit card company as a mediator rather than when you've basically written a check by paying by debit card.
All right. Good things to know as we head out on the road, and we will be continuing to talk about this as the summer wears on. We've got time for a quick phone call here at Kevin McKinley's On Your Money. Let's head to Kenosha, and Tom joins us. Good morning, Tom.
Hi, Kevin. My question is in regard to the Series I savings bonds that you were talking about a couple mm-hmm. weeks ago. And how it relates to this talk about the debt ceiling that is going to potentially be hit on August 2nd. So what I'm wondering is, it's a twofold question. First of all, does that mean that if they don't raise the debt ceiling, that after August 2nd, the government will no longer be able to borrow money, so therefore you can't buy savings bonds after that date? Or will it affect the government's ability to pay the interest on the bonds that I buy?
Okay, lots of good topics in that short question. Series I savings bonds, the I stands for inflation, and they provide an inflation-adjusted interest rate that through November is at 4.6% on an annualized basis, and that interest is exempt from state taxes as well. There's some really neat things about those. But of course, it is, you're basically, when you buy that, you're lending money to the United States government, hoping that they'll pay you back accordingly. And many people, as they hear more about the debt ceiling, they're worried that if there'll be a shutdown or the government won't pay it. I'll be blown away if there isn't an eventual increase in the debt ceiling, allowing the government to borrow more money for it. And for better or for worse, Series I savings bonds, treasuries, other government, direct government-backed bonds are still going to be the safest investment out there, because if the debt ceiling isn't raised and the federal government runs into a bunch of problems, all other investments are going to be affected as well. So there is no real safe harbor for your money, more so than these bonds. It's uncharted territory, but again, it's more political saber rattling than anything else. So I wouldn't stay away from Series I savings bonds because you were concerned about the debt ceiling or the government's financial situation.
Is this something that you've been getting more questions about, people wondering how secure their investments in government bonds might be?
Absolutely, because it's in front of our face almost every day. If you're paying attention, there's obvious reasons to be concerned about the local and state and federal government stability. For better or for worse, though, right now the United States government is still the safest borrower that there is in the world. And so many things are predicated on the government of the United States being healthy that it's difficult to find some kind of shelter of liquidity for paper savings other than something that's either inherently or explicitly backed by Uncle Sam.
All right. Lots and lots to think about. Something else to think about is our website of the week. What you got for us?
Well, we mentioned that Google has come out with the Google Wallet to help you pay for things using their technology and a credit card. Google also has Advisor, Google Advisor. Ostensibly is supposed to help you make financial decisions by having you lots of different rates and offers for mortgages and credit cards, CDs, checking accounts, savings accounts nationwide, all in one place. So if you're looking around for some type of financial service, this is usually a good place to start and consider as part of your hunt. And it's google.com/advisor/home. And we'll have a link up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And the benefit of having a website like this is just that everything is in one place and it can help you sort out some of these options?
Yeah, it does. And I'm sure there's some, you know, fees back for it, but there's so many different places out there. And when you're talking about money, it's very difficult to know whom and what you can trust. So this is one place you can at least get some leads into information and compare different offers all in one place.
All right. Very good. That address again. And as Kevin mentioned, we'll have a link on that posted a little bit later on today. But you just go to google.com/advisor/home. And Kevin, believe it or not, we have come to the end of the hour. And four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
All right. There you go. And have a great day, Kevin. Thanks for joining us. Kevin McKinley is On Your Money, and it's here every week, Tuesdays at 8 o'clock here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kevin McKinley, of course, is a registered certified financial planner and a managing member of McKinley Money, and his website, by the way, is onyourmoney.com if you'd like to check it out for yourself. If you'd like a copy of this program, you can call the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program 614C. You can also check out our web archives. They're waiting for you 24 hours a day, and you can find those at WPR.org. We usually post the programs pretty much the same day that they're aired, and you can come back and listen anytime. Bill Martin's produced this hour. We had on-air production from Chris Molina. I'm Gene Purcell. I'm here this week filling in for Joy Cardine, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.